IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Today we have with us a very special guest, Madhuvanti Srinivasan. Madhuvanti is a journalist who extensively follows Turkey, especially in Turkish language sources. So we can get almost a first-hand account of really what is happening in possibly the most interesting country in the Middle East. Welcome, Madhuvanti, to All Things Policy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
So over the course of the next half an hour or so, Aditya and I will be discussing West Asia or the Middle East with Madhuvanti. We'll be talking a great deal about how exactly Turkey functions within, really what makes Turkey tick. And finally, we will be discussing what Turkey is up to in the Indian subcontinent, its relationships with Pakistan, Bangladesh, and of course, India. So let's get straight to it. Madhuvanti, our first question to you would be, help us understand the internal politics of Turkey a little better. Now, as an outsider looking in, relying mostly on English media news sources, I see some broad similarities. There is a very strong nationalist tendency in Turkey. There is a charismatic president comparable to our prime minister. And of course, you have a very, very devoted fan base to the prime minister in India and to the president in Turkey. But there's also much deeper similarities that you were talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Right. It's a very interesting question. And in fact, this is, I think, one aspect that often goes unexplored in terms of the similarities between Turkey and India. As you mentioned, both Narendra Modi and Recep Tayyip Erdogan are extremely charismatic leaders with fan bases that are fiercely committed and dedicated to their cause and to their leadership. And also in terms of the way opposition systems work in both the countries and the way there is some sort of a crackdown on press and on independent press in both the countries is, I think, something that is very similar. If there is a possible difference, it could only be more so in the degree at which all of these seems to be functioning. So if you look at the way the main opposition party of Turkey, which is the CHP, and the way in which they swept the mayoral elections last year in the three main cities of Turkey, which include Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir, is very similar to how the BJP was decimated in Delhi last year. And, you know, you had an Arvind Kejriwal coming up with an overwhelming majority in the elections. So I think opposition and the way systems function and the way opposition is also demonized to a great extent. And, you know, the kind of discourse and conversations that happen between the ruling party and the opposition is something that's very similar between Turkey and India. And if you look at the way the press functions in both the countries, I think you do have a good, fair number of independent journalists within the country and outside the country, both in Turkey and India, who are trying to be very critical, are trying to question what is happening and are trying to bring the real picture of, you know, what is really happening in both the countries. But you do also have a very dedicated section of the media which toes the government line, which is all praises for the president and the prime minister, with no questions asked on the decisions taken, and are always of the opinion that whatever the government does is the best, and whatever the opposition or the questions raised against the government, how do I put this? In fact, I would say that the section of media or the pro-establishment media in both Turkey as well as India are extremely dedicated to the leadership, to the government, with no question asked, and are very quick to deem questions raised and those critical of the government as enemies of the state. So I think there are a lot of similarities between the two countries, often unexplored. But if there is a difference between the two, I think it is more in the case of the degree at which these systems are taking place.
Interesting. That's a very elegant macro picture that you've drawn of how Turkey works overall. But let's kind of dive a little deeper into the details, right? What really motivates support for President Erdogan? You briefly alluded to a kind of nationalist base, but what kind of historical experience, what kind of historical belief is it based on? And I think the parallel also extends in certain other ways where, for example, the founding father of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, is not as highly regarded today as he was during his own day. That, I think, is an interesting parallel to the way that India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, is not as kindly regarded today as he was in his own day.
Absolutely. So I started following Turkey very closely post 2011. And in fact, let's be very honest, I could ask this question to both you guys as well. Apart from Erdogan, is there any other prime minister or president you recognize from Turkey?
Nope.
So that's precisely the point. I think Erdogan has undoubtedly been one of the most charismatic presidents, prime ministers. He's been both a prime minister and the president. So I think he has been one of the most charismatic leaders in Turkey. And that charisma is something that has really drawn a lot of people towards him. Like, all credit needs to be given to that. And also the success with which his first term really went, where, you know, Turkey did enjoy a great deal of economic success. And, you know, there was a lot of importance that was being extended to Turkey because they were growing to be more and more important in the context of geopolitics. And also 2011 was the time when the Middle East and the entire region was undergoing a great change. So, you know, economic success and, you know, the charisma with which Erdogan connects to people in Turkey is something that greatly contributed to his popularity. And this is apart from the nationalist agenda, where people believe that Turks and Muslims, you know, the majority of the country rather, needs to be prioritized, not believing much in the secular credentials. And by listening to this, there could often be a lot of confusion even among the listeners that whether are we talking about Turkey or are we talking about India, because that is how similar both the countries are in all these contexts. So I think that is something that has really contributed to Erdogan's popularity, which is at shaky grounds at the moment for the past 1 or 2 years. It is on shaky grounds right now. But I think his charisma and the success, the economic success that he brought to Turkey, has greatly contributed. And having said that, I think his undoing of a lot of policies of Mustafa Kemal Pasha has not surely changed the way people look at Mustafa Kemal Pasha. That is, the greater Turkish nation still regards Atatürk as the father of the nation and as somebody who's done a lot of good for the nation. But there is definitely a conscious undoing of a lot of Atatürk's values and ideals in Turkey, which is again very similar to the way, as you mentioned, Nehru is looked in India and the way the BJP government is undoing a lot of Nehru's policies in the country.
Madhavanti, I want to ask you to orient our listeners. Can you tell us about the basic philosophical differences between the AKP and, say, the CHP, the party that used to previously dominate Turkish politics?
Absolutely. If you look, I think one of the biggest differences between the two is definitely the value of secularism. Of course, there are allegations against former regimes as well, where, you know, the Kurds were persecuted, the Armenians were persecuted. So there are a lot of such allegations as well. But I think secularism on the whole, in terms of, let me give you an instance. There was a time when headscarves were banned in Turkey, where women were discouraged to wear headscarves because they didn't, you know, Mustafa Kemal Pasha didn't kind of believe, you know, in sort of, he rather believed in Europeanizing, Westernizing Turkey. In fact, you know, you'll see a lot of photographs of, you know, Mustafa Kemal Pasha dancing with a woman in public. You can't even imagine anybody today doing that. And then you have an Erdogan who's coming out and who talks about how, you know, social media websites like Netflix and Twitter are not suitable for our country and how he should be having some sort of control over social media websites and their consumption in Turkey. So I think secularism and the kind of ideals of, you know, erstwhile Turkey is something that has greatly changed. That is, Turkey, for the longest time, I know of people in India who for the longest time didn't even know that Turkey was a secular country. You know, they always regarded it to be a country where Islam was the state religion, which is not the case. Turkey, as per their constitution, is a secular country. I mean, of course, Sunni Muslims at the end of the day are the majority, but constitutionally, they still continue to be a secular country. And this is a contribution of Atatürk and of the erstwhile Turkish leaders. But this, I mean, is now just becoming a part of, you know, it's just like a rubber stamp now. You know, it's just part of the constitution. But when you look at the way things have changed, you know, when the AKP came into power, there have been a lot of this entire undoing of headscarves. The headscarf ban, and, you know, of course, I mean, the debate also comes down to choices of women, etc. I mean, that's the second thing. But the undoing and how secularism as a value continues to erode in Turkey is one of the biggest differences between Erdogan and between Atatürk's Turkey.
What is interesting to me is the fact that in a lot of ways, Atatürk himself, his policies, his emphasis on secularism can be construed in a way as being a kind of vision of a new Turkey that was independent in some senses of the older kind of Ottoman legacy.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Erdogan really seems to be leaning quite heavily into the idea that modern Turkey is an inheritor of the Ottoman legacy, not merely in terms of how its domestic politics should be structured with this kind of, as you said, authoritarian system that leans on religious vote banks, but also seems to influence the way that Turkey conducts its foreign policy, right? The way that Turkey sees its influence, or as it were, its rightful duty to protect various countries in the region. So, Can you tell us a bit about that, Madhavanti?
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of analysts would always mention that, you know, Turkey's foreign policy previously, even when the AKP was in power, probably it was more gradual after Erdogan came to power. But Turkey's foreign policy was never on the basis of Sunnis and Shias before, which is a pattern that is becoming very visible in the way Turkey is conducting its foreign policy today. And today, there is some sort of consensus where you feel that, you know, a lot of countries believe that, you know, Turkey, and even Turkey for itself, also believes that, you know, they are the protector of the Muslim world and they have certain responsibility. And, you know, this extension of the Ottoman rhetoric that, you know, you were all our brothers and it is our responsibility to, you know, protect you all is something that really plays out in terms of Turkey's conduct as far as Palestine is concerned and as far as Libya is concerned and even as far as how Syria is concerned. But particularly in the context of Palestine and Libya. In fact, one of the biggest justifications given for Turkey's intervention in Libya is that they are our Ottoman brothers or they are our brothers from the times of the Ottomans. And it is our responsibility, you know, to go and protect them and, you know, to go and stand, you know, shoulder by shoulder with them and fight the enemy. So I think that Ottoman rhetoric is uniform. The Sunni Muslim rhetoric is also very uniform, though you'll never hear of persecution of Shias per se. So, which is very common in countries like Afghanistan, where you often hear about, you know, the Hazara community being persecuted simply because they are Shias, or the Shia community being persecuted in Bahrain, or Shias being persecuted in Saudi Arabia. You'll never hear stories of those kinds from Turkey, but they've not been very militant in terms of their Sunni rhetoric as well. But if you look at the way they have extended support in Syria, in Yemen, etc., I think, and of course their opposition to Assad, Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president as well, you've seen that there is some sort of a trend in Turkish interventions that they do look at Sunni groups and supporting them. So the Ottoman rhetoric and the Sunni rhetoric are introductions within Turkish foreign policy that have become all the more evident after the AKP and particularly after Erdogan came to power.
What's really interesting is that the way this rhetoric is being used, right? We see Turkey involved in these foreign military adventures, like you said, in Syria, Yemen, Libya. Some of these are kind of understandable. You understand why the Turks would be worried about Syria. You know, they're concerned about the PKK and so on. It's a neighboring country. But why are the Turks involved, for example, in Libya? And do security concerns justify the extent of their involvement in Syria? Or is something else driving these? Is it domestic politics?
Again, very interesting question. Because as you mentioned, their involvement and intervention in Syria is still very justified with their security concerns, that they're concerned about Syria and even northern Iraq, for that matter, being used as safe havens by the PKK to wage a war against Turkey. And there has been a conflict mode between the PKK and the Turkish government, the Turkish state, since the 1980s. So their intervention in Syria and their airstrikes in northern Iraq is still easy to justify. But when you look at Libya, I think, though I do extensively read about Libya, I've not quite seen a justification on Turkey's part, apart from these rhetorics and apart from, of course, the oil that Libya is home to. But apart from all of these things, I've not quite seen a very valid justification that has convinced me why Turkey has to be a part of the Libyan conflict. And, you know, they could have rather not intervened the way they have, because I think Turkey is the most overtly, has the most overt intervention in Libya at the moment. I mean, if you see a UAE, you know, it's all behind the curtains. Everybody knows that they do have a role to play, but not the way the Turks have been doing, where you have ministers going and visiting. I mean, I do understand from the point of view of the Turks that, they are kind of showing the world that we are here to stay and, you know, we will support our allies. But Turkey's intervention in Libya is something that, I mean, the justification has not surely convinced me. And as you mentioned about domestic political vote banks and, you know, making them happy, I think Erdogan does greatly use these interventions in his advantage. He does use these foreign interventions in his advantage when he talks about Syria. When he talks about the intervention in Syria, he mentions about how he's protecting the country. When he talks about his intervention in Libya, he's talking about standing with allies, standing with fellow Muslims, and standing with brothers from the times of the Ottoman. When you're talking about Palestine, you know, and his rhetoric against the looming Israeli annexation, and when the U.S. recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and how Jerusalem is the red line. You know, these are very easy statements, or these are statements that can literally give you a leverage at a time when possibly your, you know, domestic policies aren't working, there is discontent. You know, using such rhetorics, which are very emotional, you know, which are very emotionally appealing to the Turkish public, is something that gives you a lot of leverage. And Erdogan and the AKP has learned it very well. So every time there is trouble, you know, they'll always talk about the PKK, or they'll associate an opposition party with the PKK and say that these two are associated with each other and, you know, they are against Turkey. So the entire anti-national rhetoric that perpetuates in India is also a rhetoric that perpetuates in Turkey, just in different contexts. And these are then used, you know, to kind of push a leverage and possibly gain some sort of domestic approval.
So how well does this narrative actually work, Madhavanti? Like you talked about how the Turkish economy isn't doing so well. Are all these adventures really supported by the Turkish public to a great degree? Or is it really just a small and dedicated base of the AKP that these actions are meant to play for? What really is the Turkish public's mood regarding Erdogan's foreign adventures?
As you mentioned, that small, dedicated community, you know, that surely supports the AKP and the Erdogan, of course, don't question what he's doing in Syria and in Libya. But you do have some people who are critical and who do believe that, you know, at a time when your economy is not doing well, you know, such expensive adventures, because, you know, interventions in countries like Libya and Syria also do involve a lot of money. So you know, you have people questioning the government by saying that, you know, are we in a position where we can spend that kind of money, you know, where we can spend that kind of money and intervene in these countries? Is it required? And as I've mentioned previously as well, you do have a lot of informal surveys that keep going in and out about how Turkish public looks at, you know, these foreign interventions, and the numbers keep fluctuating. So you can't quite understand whether the Turkish public is supporting Erdogan. So it's never, you know, a full-fledged majority. You'll never have the entire country supporting Erdogan over a foreign intervention. That's never the case. That there is a significant community that does question, that does remain critical of Turkey's foreign interventions. So apart from the ones who are dedicatedly very supportive to Erdogan, you do have people who do question them and who are very critical of these foreign interventions and question the very need for Turkey to be intervening in all these countries.
That's an interesting point. I mean, the fact that despite all the AKP does, despite its army of like social media warriors, who, let me tell you, are like fairly well known in all sections of the internet. It's quite fascinating to me that there are certain nationalist groups that are very well known on the internet. Turkish nationalists are very well known. Serbian nationalists are very well known. And of course, Indian nationalists are very well known on the internet. So once again, a parallel between both of our countries. But that brings me to another question that I wanted to ask you, Madhuvanti, about the way that Turkey interacts with Indians just generally. What really does Turkey think about the subcontinent more generally, which includes our neighbors, of course, Pakistan and Bangladesh? And what does Turkey really think of India? What direction do you see these relationships heading towards in the years to come?
As far as South Asia is concerned, I think Turkey is still making its way in terms of the way it interacts with the region. They are involved to a certain extent in Afghanistan and the entire Afghan conflict and negotiations with the Taliban and the government. And as I had mentioned, they have extremely close, very warm ties with Pakistan. And you do have a lot of cultural exchange happening, a lot of Pakistani students who go on Turkish government scholarships to study. And I mean, there is a lot of cooperation that happens between Pakistan and Turkey. And Turks look at Pakistan as, you know, a brotherly nation of sorts. Also very close to Bangladesh, not as much as what Pakistan is. I mean, not as close as what they are to Pakistan, but definitely close to Bangladesh. As far as India is concerned, Turkey and India are two countries which have huge potential in terms of cooperation. And I think both the countries are misunderstood. Turkey is also misunderstood in India. India is also misunderstood by the Turks, apart from the ones who do, I mean, who do know what they're saying. But there is a lot of misconceptions and there is a lot of misunderstandings regarding both the countries. And there are certain contentious issues as well in terms of Turkey's position on Kashmir and their support for Pakistan. But I think things are diluting slightly. And you are seeing that Turkey has started recognizing India as a very important partner as far as the region is concerned. And I think I would foresee more conversations happening between the two countries. Turkey is also looking at establishing two more consulates in India. So there is an effort being made for conversations to happen. But as I said, there are certain very traditional, typical misunderstandings which are hampering the cooperation between the two countries. And one is definitely their proximity to Pakistan.
What are the sort of misconceptions that Turks have about India?
Very interesting again. So I think one very big misconception that they have about us is that I wouldn't say it's a misconception, but I think it's more of a concern. Turks and Turkey in general are becoming a little vocal about how Muslims are being treated and believe that, you know, there is some sort of a second degree treatment that is being extended to Muslims in India. And they are very concerned and worried about it. And the others are very, how do I say? These are very normal sort of misconceptions. Oh, India is very dirty, unclean, etc., etc. Those kind of misconceptions. which you do make, and if you do have a conversation with a Turk, you know, you can kind of change that. But I think, and you did see a lot of public discourse during the attack on Jamia Millia Islamia, during the Delhi riots this year, a lot of Turks coming out and talking about, you know, what, everything that is happening in India. They've been very vocal about Kashmir. A lot of conversations did happen over Article 370 and its abrogation. And I think Turkey has been very vocal about all of those things. And there are certain misconceptions, but I think those are because there is fundamentally a lot of disinformation. And I also believe that the misinformation and the misconceptions in Turkey is also partly because India is not covered very extensively in Turkey, just like how Turkey is not very extensively covered in India. So the understanding of both the countries are not as good as what it should be. So there are misconceptions. The others are the general ones that you have, you know, the typical Indian misconceptions about India being dirty, cows, this and that. So, but apart from that, I think simply because a lot of focus is not extended towards both the countries, that is India in Turkey and Turkey in India, it gives a lot of scope for misinformation, which leads to a lot of misconceptions.
Interesting. So, I have one final question from you, Madhavanti, which I've received on special request from Pranay Kotasthane, the head of research at Takshashila, and it is extremely serious. So please give us a very sincere answer. And that is, I have heard that Turkish soap operas are really good. Which ones are worth watching? Is it true that Ertugrul is good? Imran Khan is a big fan and it's really big in Pakistan.
One, I think it's a brilliant question by Pranay. I, in fact, started getting very fascinated by Turkey just because of soap operas. And I started learning Turkish by watching these Turkish soaps. and I think my mother till today regrets my decision to start watching Turkish soaps. But having said that, Ertugrul is, yes, very popular in Pakistan, popular in India as well. A lot of people have been watching. A lot of people are extremely fascinated, you know, by the very similar words that are used in both Turkish as well as Hindi/Urdu. So, you know, that kind of gives that, you know, oh my God, we are so connected with Turkey sort of a feeling. And in all honesty, I haven't watched it yet. So I wouldn't quite recommend it. I end up watching a lot of rom-coms and the cheesy Turkish soaps, which I'm not quite sure if Pranay will enjoy. But apart from that, I think, yes, Ertugrul and Turkish soap operas have ended up playing a huge role in Turkey's soft power push all across the country. You won't believe I'm part of a Facebook group which watches Turkish soaps with English subtitles. So this was at a time when I just started learning Turkish and I needed assistance. And I would watch them with English subtitles. Hmm. And I've ended up making friends from all across the world. So I have people right from South Korea till Latin America, Eastern Europe, even a country like Greece with whom Turkey doesn't enjoy the best of relations. Hmm. A lot of South Asians, Indians are growing very interested in Turkish soap operas. Pakistanis have always been, Afghans. In fact, in Afghanistan, that transition from Chunki Saas Bhi Kabhi Bahu Thi to Turkish soap operas has been over the years. At a time when Indian soap operas were extremely popular in Afghanistan, Afghan TV sets now have more fascination towards Turkish soap operas. Iran, Iraq, across the Arab world, you have Turkish soap operas being translated into Arabic and into multiple regional languages. In fact, I read the statistics recently that after the United States, if there is a country that exports the most number of TV content across the world, it is Turkey. So I think they have really pushed their case in terms of soap operas. And Ertugrul definitely is a game changer. But there have also been a lot of other extremely good ones, which I think unfortunately gets missed because of no English subtitles.
That is so interesting. So very clearly, Indians and Turks divided by a lack of knowledge about each other, but united by politics and more importantly, by the most enduring of all human forces, soap operas. On that note, thank you so much, Madhuvanti, for joining us. And thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.